That's the sound of Sputnik, which was launched in 1957. The Russian craft was the first satellite in orbit, but after its batteries died and before it burned up in the atmosphere, it was also the first piece of space junk. Today, there are thousands upon thousands of pieces of orbital debris circling the planet, old satellites, fragments of rockets, and even paint fleck-sized particles, all traveling at high speeds. Even in the vastness of space, all this detritus poses a threat to satellites and manned spacecraft. We're joined now by Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute, and by Mark Matley of NASA's Orbital Debris Program Office at the Johnson Space Center. I'm very pleased that it brings both of them to our program today for our first underreported segment. Hello.
Hello. Hi, Leonard.
Mark, how many pieces of space junk are currently estimated to be orbiting the planet?
Well, that all depends on what's the size you're talking about. If you're talking about objects that the U.S. Space Surveillance Network, that's our military radar system, can track, we're currently tracking about 22,000 objects, and that's down to about 10 centimeters, about 4 inches in size.
So that's about the size of a softball?
Something like that, yeah.
And then there's a lot more that's smaller, and we have no idea. Pea-sized and smaller than that?
Yes. About pea size, we're talking in the hundreds of thousands of debris, and there's even more as you go on down, smaller than a grain of sand.
How fast are most of these particles traveling?
Well, in order to stay in orbit, they have to have a pretty high rate of speed. The typical for low Earth orbit, we're talking about something of order 5 miles per second or 8 kilometers per second. That's somewhere around 18,000 miles per hour, and they're a little slower at higher altitudes.
And at what size do they pose a risk to spacecraft?
Well, the 1 centimeter objects, the ones that are pea size, will pretty much damage any spacecraft they hit, except for the space station. It's specially shielded. But anything much larger than about 1 centimeter is dangerous for any spacecraft.
And what would happen? Would they put a hole in it? What about an astronaut in a spacesuit on a spacewalk?
Yeah, that is a concern. Fortunately, an astronaut is a relatively small target. The problem is it's sort of like radiation. The problem is an exposure time issue. You know, the space station's been up there for more than 10 years, and it's in the environment all the time, whereas an astronaut's only out for about 8 hours. And it's also his physical size. He's only a few square meters in size, whereas the space station is very large.
Derek, wasn't there a very high-profile collision in space last year between the Iridium 33 satellite and a defunct communications satellite?
Yes, there was a very high-profile collision, and indeed it created a tremendous amount of additional material to be floating around in space as space junk. And, you know, the danger is that the more of this material that's created, the greater the chances are that something like this is going to happen again. And so we can look forward to, unless we start to do something about all that's up there, we can look forward to finding more and more of these pieces.
So when space junk hits space junk, you get a lot more space junk.
Yeah, you do. There's this really interesting process that happens in which that's exactly what happens, because as one object crashes into something else, it's creating a lot more pieces, and then those pieces are free to impact other objects and create more stuff. And so, you know, the targets, in some sense, you might say that some of the targets reduce in size, but it creates more ammunition to strike more targets.
I would assume that each launch creates a small amount of orbital debris because things fall off the rockets.
Well, there is that. There is a small amount of orbital debris that does fall off the rocket, and some of the mitigating things that have been done recently to try to reduce the amount of stuff is that, you know, engineers will depressurize fuel tanks in launch vehicles in rocket bodies that are left over to reduce the incidence of explosion and thereby creating more materials. And some of that material actually that falls off during launch does fall back into the Earth's atmosphere and burn up on reentry. So there's, you know, both a deposit of additional material, and then some of that material falls back and is lost on reentry.
Earlier this month, the Russian space agency Roscosmos issued a report saying that China is responsible for nearly 40% of all orbital debris. Why China? Aren't they fairly new to space flight?
Well, they are new to space flight, but, you know, one of the things that happened was that The Chinese deliberately destroyed one of their own spacecraft a couple of years ago, and that created a tremendous amount of material of considerable size, more than 2,000 pieces that are bigger than the 4-inch size. And a whole host of those sort of fragments in the 1-centimeter size. So this is a tremendous addition to what was already there.
And why did they do that? Were they doing an experiment?
Yeah, it was an experiment to see if they could create an anti-satellite weapon that could be used to destroy satellites in orbit. And you know, when we say used to destroy satellites in orbit, we aren't really talking about here the Chinese testing their capability to destroy their own satellites. In some ways, you know, this is looked upon by national security systems in countries around the world as the Chinese testing out their capability to destroy other satellites. So there's a military component to this idea of what's there for space junk, and you know how we think about what we do with it going forward in the future.
Mark, I'm assuming this is something of concern to NASA. Did the Chinese test their test of the satellite weapon? Was it a success?
In the sense of from a military standpoint, it sure looks like it was a success. They destroyed their target, but from a risk standpoint, that debris is going to be up for a very, very long time. And years ago, the international community talked about rules about how you test things like tests like that. And one of the things is you don't want to create lots of long-lived debris. That means if you create a little bit of debris, it's not a big problem. If you create lots of debris that is short-lived, it doesn't stay in space for very long, it's not a big problem. That's essentially what happened when we did the USA-193 intercept a few years ago. Most all of that debris has now reentered. It is no longer a risk to the orbital environment.
This month also marks the 50th anniversary of the first dogs in space, Belka and Strelka. They went up on the Sputnik 5 Soviet craft. What happened to them?
If I'm not mistaken, Mark, you can help confirm this. Unfortunately, Belka and Strelka, they both died on reentry, I think, into the Earth's atmosphere. And it may have been that they also lost consciousness while in orbit, but their space junk, I believe, was reentered the Earth's atmosphere.
I think that's correct.
We've been sending all sorts of stuff up the last decade. We've sent up a number of GPS-enabled devices, and our communication needs are greater than ever. I'm guessing all of that has translated into more satellites orbiting the Earth. And they're not yet space junk, but they soon will be. How many are up there, do you know?
How many operational satellites?
What's up there beyond the space junk? What's up there that's going to become space junk?
Well, there's about 1,000 operational satellites. We define space junk or space debris as any orbiting object, man-made orbiting object, that no longer serves a useful purpose. So there's about 1,000 objects up there that are still operating and doing what they were designed to do. But I don't know if I said this earlier, there's about 22,000 total tracked objects, and about 15,500 of those are cataloged, which means we know who launched them, when they launched them, what it is. But that's a lot of objects that are up there that are no longer functional.
Well, as you mentioned, the Sputnik craft burned up in the atmosphere, but aren't there still some satellites from the late 1950s still orbiting Earth?
Well, the oldest piece of space junk up there is the Vanguard 1 spacecraft, which was launched in March 1958. And it's going to be up there for quite a while longer. It's at a pretty high altitude orbit. So
it won't be sucked in by Earth's gravity for a while?
Well, it's the gravity is what it's not the gravity that sucks them in. It's the Earth's atmospheric drag. The drag acts like the friction from the atmosphere slows them down, so they gradually spiral into the Earth's atmosphere and burn up. So as a result, debris and spacecraft at low altitudes experience more atmosphere than ones at high altitudes.
I'm talking with Mark Matney of NASA's Orbital Debris Program Office at the Johnson Space Center, and with Derek Pitts, Chief Astronomer at the Franklin Institute. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Derek, is there ever a risk of something not burning up and hitting the planet? Didn't Skylab come down pretty much all in one piece?
Well, there is that risk, and that risk comes with objects that are pretty large that aren't in some sort of a high-altitude orbit where they will remain for some time. But and out of the grasp of the Earth's atmosphere, as Mark pointed out, which is a very important aspect of this. But yes, those larger, more massive objects that can come down, make the transition through the Earth's atmosphere, and not completely burn up, can fall in one of two places. They can either fall, they could fall on land, or they could fall in the ocean. And, you know, thank goodness the Earth's surface is, you know, more than three-quarters ocean. That gives a much larger target for some of this debris to fall into. But occasionally, some of these pieces can fall on land as well. And when you look at the distribution of population across the planet, one of the things you discover is that there are plenty of open areas where these materials could fall, where they would not do any damage to civilization, cities, or any place where people are living, and that's a good thing. But if we have control of them and can see to it that this is where these things fall, that's a good thing. But in a couple of instances, particularly in the Skylab instance, and unfortunately the destruction of the Space Shuttle Columbia, we weren't able to control where they were falling in, and so pieces fell in places where there were inhabitants. So there is that risk as well, but for the most part, that kind of instance doesn't take place.
Although if they fall in the oceans, that's not always so great. In our next segment, we're going to be talking about a gigantic garbage patch in the Atlantic Ocean. We've earlier discussed the one in the Pacific. There's a lot of junk floating around in our oceans as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Mark, hasn't NASA found that some old rockets and satellites, if they're left on their own, will actually explode after a period of time? Why is that?
That's something that Derek mentioned a moment ago. For a long time, when people would use their upper stages or their spacecraft, they would leave residual fuel on board after they were done with them, because the engineers always carry a little bit of extra fuel. And because a rocket is a controlled explosion, when they left the fuel on board, we would occasionally have, especially rocket bodies, or sometimes spacecraft, that would just spontaneously explode. And that created a lot of shrapnel. So one of the early things that was done in this office was to educate users around the world that said, hey, when you're done with your spacecraft or your rocket body, vent that extra propellant so it's not a bomb waiting to explode in the future.
Is there a tipping point, Derek, at which point we'll just have too much debris to operate satellites safely in low Earth orbit?
Well, I mean, the problem is that, you know, as space gets more crowded, then the risk of impacts and destruction of useful satellites just gets greater and greater and greater. And so it behooves us at this point to have an office like where Mark works to try to figure out how to mitigate, what's going to happen as more and more of the stuff increases on orbit. So we hope not to get to that point where we have so much stuff that it really is causing enough risk to low Earth orbit access that we really have to start to question, you know, can we do this, or how easily can we do this, or is the risk too great for us to actually put something there? Space is big. There's a lot of room. We shouldn't sort of give any sort of idea that we're crowding the skies to a point where it's causing that big an issue. But the point is that we really need to move on trying to figure out how to better control what's there, how to get rid of what's there if possible, and keep low Earth orbit as safe as we possibly can.
Mark, I was wondering if we have the ability to monitor all these objects in space with a degree of accuracy that in some cases we know from which object they came. Has anyone raised the issue of liability if there's an accidental collision between a piece of junk and a communication satellite?
Yes, there's actually a treaty in the UN, an outer space treaty, that talks about liability in space.
And are there property rights in space?
Yes, there are, and I'm not sure that's exactly the legal term, but there is a liability convention that says that the launching country is liable for damage that's caused by their spacecraft if fault can be shown in a court of law.
I've read about proposals to send up spacecraft equipped with giant nets. Derek, is the idea of deploying hundreds of nets into space at all practical?
Well, that's a great question. I don't think it's very practical to deploy huge nets because, you know, one of the things you have to do is how are you going to go about this? I mean, we're talking about material that is, you know, in size from 1 centimeter and smaller up to very large pieces. We're talking about operational satellites versus defunct satellites. How would we ever manage to sort of separate out everything and pick one from another? It would make much more sense to be much more discreet about the targets and figure out ways in which we can deorbit some of the material in a way that it can safely burn up on reentry into the Earth's atmosphere. So NET sounds like it'd be a great thing, possibly, but not really because it has too many other problems associated with it. As I said, going with that discrete idea of picking out particular ones is a much better idea.
Mark, haven't some space agencies considered robotic missions that would dock with old satellites and fire their rockets to send them into deep space?
Yes, there's lots of research going on in that direction because one of the things we've learned in recent years is that you kind of mentioned before that we're sort of at a position now that if we didn't do anything, if we stopped launching today, the amount of debris would continue to rise over the coming decades. And so we're kind of moving into a phase where we need to not only design future spacecraft so they get themselves out of the environment, but we actually have to go up and do some cleanup at some time in the future. And so people are looking at ideas to do that in an economically reasonable way and see if there's easy, inexpensive ways to remove the mass that's already up there, objects.
There was a recent proposal to put balloons into satellites and inflate them at the end of the craft's life.
If you can increase the area of like a rocket body, if you can increase its area, you can increase its drag rate. That's true, and you can bring it out of the environment quicker, at least when it's in the lower part of Earth's orbit, where the atmosphere can affect it. When I saw that article, the only thing I thought of was balloons. As most children know, balloons are easily popped, and so there are small debris and meteoroids that can pop balloons. So.
Derek, there's been concern about the weaponization of space, and I have to assume that any technology to remove defunct satellites could also be used by a military to destroy an active satellite, of the sort of thing that the Chinese have experimented with.
Well, yeah. In fact, you know, there is a mission that the Air Force is trying to get off the ground now called the Space-Based Surveillance Satellite that is intended to take a look at every satellite that's in a geostationary orbit at least once a day. And the idea is for this satellite to be able to keep very, very good track of the satellites that are there in order to avoid collisions between various satellites. But at the same time, this system is also monitoring, as I said, every other geostationary satellite that's there. We have systems in place now in which we can identify when collisions between satellites are imminent, and we can warn the countries that own those satellites of this imminent collision in hopes that they might be able to do something like, you know, slightly move their satellite just out of position enough to avoid a collision. Well, this also raises the question and issue. You know, we have the ability to monitor everything that's going on there. And the weaponization of space certainly does sort of fall in this category of moving in this direction of being able to monitor every satellite that's there. Does that or does that not give us some advantage as far as, you know, either an offensive position or a defensive position against other satellites in orbit?
Our knowledgeable audience is always catching me and making mistakes. And it was Laika that went up in the Soviet craft 50 years ago this month, not Belka and Strelka. They went up another time. My great thanks to the both of you for talking with us. Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute, Mark Matney of NASA's Orbital Debris Program at the Johnson Space Center.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.